Hey everybody, this is Dr. Russ. Thank you for jumping in on the Speaker Box Podcast. Today, I got two guests with me. I have Bill Banham with HR Gazette and Chris Bjorling with Fidelo. And we are going to talk about sports and leadership. You guys know I love to talk about sports. So we take this in July of 2021. And earlier that year, I had spoken at the Innovate Work virtual conference. And I met Bill and I was on a pod, his pod, HR Gazette. And normally when we take pods, we have a conversation beforehand. My conversation with Bill was about 45 minutes and we were just talking sports. We started out talking Premier League soccer. He's a big fan of Norwich Canaries and I am a big fan of Manchester United. But from there, he's based in Toronto. So we talked a little baseball. We talked a little hockey. We talked a little football. And we really regretted that we did not start taping from the beginning because we had a really good conversation because we linked it to leadership and current events. So we decided to have a conversation about sports on my podcast. And we brought in our good friend Chris Bjorling with Fidelo, and they focus on leadership performance. They've been doing this thing for over 30 years. And the three of us just chopped it up. Talking about sports from the fan perspective, the teams we support, our experiences as fans, good and bad. And then we transition to talk about the link between sports and leadership. So with that being said, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll jump right into this conversation with Bill Banham and Chris Bjorling. So I'm excited to have this conversation with my good friends, Bill Banham and Chris Bjorling. We are sports fans, so we are going to talk about our love of sports. And because we are HRD experts, we're going to find a way to weave it into culture and leadership. So Chris and Bill, man, thanks for joining me for this conversation.
Russell, thank you so much. It's a delight to be here. You are awesome. And we both really appreciate the opportunity to come onto your podcast.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation today. I've heard so much about you. Bill's pumped you up. So don't disappoint me, Russell.
Yeah, you know, Bill lives a low lifestyle. You know, he supports, you know, it depends. Are you getting Championship Norwich or Premier League Norwich? It all kind of depends. So we'll try to give you the EPL version. So, Chris, why don't you tell me a little something about yourself?
So, awesome. Yeah, no, I have been a sports fan my whole life. I've played football. I've played baseball. I've played basketball. I've coached football for years, a lot of years, at the school levels for the kids and youth leagues and coached baseball at youth leagues. And I actually have a phys ed degree. And so there's a lot of love of the concept of sports in my life with where we're going to. But having said that, I started my company back in 87 and it's all HR focused. And so, you know, the concept like you talked about on our kickoff here, which is weaving the two together, it really does play because when you are a coach of a team, you really, you know, the ultimate developmental manager that sits out there. And so it is a great opportunity for to look at what's worked, what hasn't worked, what's worked for periods of time. Why has that changed? You know, a lot of stuff that we're probably going to hopefully talk about today too.
Bill Banham, tell me something about yourself.
Hello, everybody. I am Bill Banham. I am a secret didgeridoo player. My favorite color is yellow because my favorite soccer club, let's say soccer, shall we, because, you know, primarily a North American audience, is Norwich City, the mighty Canaries, the fearsome creature that is a canary. Until about 10, 12 years ago, all of my favorite sports were European based, I'm afraid to say. So soccer, rugby, cricket, Formula One. And then I saw the light when I moved over to beautiful Toronto, and I gave up cricket much to my dad's annoyance, and I became a big baseball fan, and I am a fan of the Blue Jays, which is not easy because they don't win much, but it's a beautiful, beautiful spectacle, and you've got to stick with it. Oh, yeah, and on the professional side, I should mention that too. I am the founder of the HR Gazette and the host of the HR Chat podcast, as well as some event series for HR folk, including one that Russell's spoken at called Innovate Work.
And Chris, where are you coming to us from?
I'm coming from upstate New York, or as the downstairs like to call, actually Western New York. So you're Rochester. So.
Okay. We're doing the audio of this, but I'm rocking my Manchester United hat. Chris is rocking an awesome football team, the Kansas City Chiefs. And Bill is rocking his Norwich Canaries. The interesting fact about Norwich is they're owned by Delia Smith. And I have a Delia Smith cookbook in my house. Can the two of you just tell me about some of your favorite teams and how you came to represent them? And let's start with Bill.
Yeah, sure thing. So I've got a few, and I'm probably going to chat about them throughout today's conversation. So let's start with Norwich City. It's never not an exciting season being a Norwich fan, because you're either getting promoted or you're getting relegated. They're a provincial team in the east coast of England. Over 100 years old. We haven't really won much over the years. Nothing to note, but we've got a beautiful garish yellow shirt that maybe blinds some of our opponents sometimes, and that's our secret weapon, along with Delia Smith, our chairperson, who maybe puts funny things into the players' food, perhaps during, I don't know. So Norwich City, they're my main soccer club. I followed them since I was a little boy. And another team that I'd like to point out, because I just think they're awesome and they stand for a lot of amazing things, is the Mercedes Formula One team. And Lewis Hamilton, of course, drives for them. In my opinion, I think that Lewis Hamilton might be the greatest sports person of all time. And this could probably be a conversation for another podcast, just dedicated on whether that's true or not. But I love Mercedes, particularly because I love Lewis Hamilton. The Blue Jays, I should mention Blue Jays, that they are my baseball team. A bit like Norwich City, they're a labor of love. It's not easy watching the Blue Jays sometimes, certainly, but they get me excited. And also I do follow the England men's rugby team, because, well, you've got more chance of success following them than you do the soccer team, frankly, given our performances since 1966.
Although you guys came close last month. I don't know what Southgate was thinking in that second half, though, from a tactical standpoint. But the fact that you guys, you know, made it to the Euro finals had to be an upside.
Gareth Southgate's a great guy. I'm sure we'll get to talk a bit more about him later on. But he stands for all of the good things in that setup. There are still a lot of bad things. A lot of bad things happened after the game with the fans, which... As a British citizen, it's shameful, but he's a great guy. He's an upstanding chap, and he's trying to lead in a different way. So kudos to him.
And Chris, talk about your favorite teams and how you came to be a fan.
That's a great one. You referenced the hat I was wearing, which we know we're audio only, but I'm wearing a Chiefs hat, and it's a recent Super Bowl hat. But I had the opportunity as a young kid to not choose the Minnesota Vikings in 1970 because my older brother demanded that I could not choose them. And so I had to support the Kansas City Chiefs back then. And since that day, and since beating my brother in the bet, I have been a Chiefs fan. It's really kind of shallow, but I have been a lifelong fan. And, you know, Bill, like you say, you've been through a lot of it. Not a lot of good. And that's what I can say for the Chiefs too. Having been through that history and being there, you know, there was some ups and downs and mostly a lot of downs. And now we're on the riding a good win streak here. And we're kind of excited about that. And they are thrilling to watch just from their style of play. So I love that. Over the years, you know, other sports too, I've you know, I've kind of fluctuated on who I like in the NBA. I've been a good Knicks fan years ago, Celtics fan, and then a Jazz fan because I ended up spending a lot of time in Utah, both working and in college. And I just learned to like their hard nut approach to working through things back when Jerry Sloan coached them and things. And for baseball, I'm a Baltimore fan. And so Bill and I chatted about that fact that, you know, the Baltimore days and, yeah, some more of those things. So those are kind of where I'm at like that. I don't really follow football or soccer too much. It's not big in our area that where I live. We have some minor league teams that have been really good over the years, but they're not supported well, unfortunately, here. And so it's one of those sports that I've kind of, you know, not really followed to the degree that you two guys have.
Yeah, and see, for me, I'm a DC native, so I'm for all of the hometown teams, which as a kid was great. I mean, last night was the last game of the Bucks and the Suns, and being a Washington Bullets fan growing up, they were good. I mean, they won their one championship in 78 against Seattle. Seven game series. I went to game six. I must have been 9 years old. And at that age, anything's possible with your team. Like, I'm older now. So, like, the Washington football team, you know, if you can be eliminated from the playoffs by Columbus Day, then I can make holiday vacation plans. Like, just don't keep me hanging on. But back then, you knew they were going to be good. And then Joe Gibbs came, and I'll say their old name, the Redskins, were great. And the Caps were exciting. So where you all are now with the Chiefs and Norwich, and Bill talked about the Toronto Raptors, I think before we started recording, I've been living the other end of it where my team I love is just horrific. I think early 2000s, I was reading Sports Illustrated, and there was an article about a soccer team, Manchester United, that had signed Tim Howard from the New York Metro Stars. I think that was their name back in MLS. And it just fascinated me. And I started to, that's how I got into Manchester United and started to follow them. And then, you know, as Bill knows, Tim Howard moved on to Everton, and that's really where he cut his career. But the manager of Manchester, Sir Alex Ferguson, is just phenomenal. So I really became a deeper fan because of his leadership style. So, and I think we've got some good nuggets we can explore here. I guess before we transition into leadership, so I want to ask you both your favorite and worst moment as a fan. You know, you can pick your team, pick your scenario.
So my favorite, you know, it kind of comes, but I'm going to say the last Super Bowl that we won, not the one we lost just recently, but the one the Chiefs won. It was great to be there finally after so many years, 50 years, you know, from an anniversary standpoint, and to win it again. It was fun to watch a young talent and Patrick Mahomes just lead a team and go, and everybody responded to Andy Reid. And it was just, you know, we're going to talk about the leadership aspects of things. And when we get into that, I'll delve into a few more of those components. But it was just fun to watch it and to be part of it again after, you know, waiting a good portion of my life, not seeing them really be greatly successful or even successful in the playoffs. So watching the Super Bowl was great. It was fun. It was fun last year when Mahomes was laying out sideways, going down to the ground, and throws the ball, and it hits our running back in the face mask, and he drops it. But it was still a great throw. It was just beautiful. But it was, you know, it's a failure moment, but it was still beautiful. And his worst fan moments, there's a lot. But one of the most frustrating ones is that because the Chiefs would come in and go out of the playoffs and they wouldn't really win. They'd come and then maybe win or once or now and then, but they kind of would always lose. And they were beating a team and the other team's quarterback goes to throw in the end zone and our defensive cornerback knocks the ball down. And you're thinking, this is great. Well, unfortunately he knocked it back to the quarterback who grabbed it and ran it in for a touchdown. And we lost. So that was just a knife cutting, back-breaking moment when you're just like, we're going to win. And then it's like, well, of course, you know, one of those times. So.
And Bill, best and favorite and worst moments.
Okay, so I've got a couple of favorites and I've got one standout worst for sure. So a couple of favorites are when Lewis Hamilton won his first Formula One championship when he was racing for McLaren. For the listeners of this show, if you don't know Lewis Hamilton's history and how his dad aided Lewis to get the opportunity to get into Formula One, check it out. It's an incredible story. I was lucky enough to meet Lewis's dad many, many years ago, and he's just a great guy, and the morals that he instilled into his son are incredible, and the hard work that his son's put in, that work ethic that his son has got, is awesome. I am such a fanboy of Lewis Hamilton that his first championship and his most recent one, which was his seventh, which equaled Michael Schumacher's all-time record, they gave me great satisfaction and joy and big smile across my face. The other amazing best moment for me was the 1999 Champions League final. And Russell, you'll appreciate this as a Manchester United fan. So I was born in 83. I missed those years when the British clubs were dominating Europe. And then they got thrown out for a number of years, okay, in the mid to late 80s because of the behavior of the fans, frankly. And so when I was growing up, Italian soccer was the thing. The Italian league was the big league. And Manchester United of the mid to late 90s were the first British club to really come back into the European arena and start to look like a credible team. And I remember sitting around my friend Nick's house when we were about 15, 16 years old, watching the final. And it wasn't the game which was the best moment. It was the last 3 minutes in injury time. They were 1-0 down. I was dejected. Me and Nick were both supporting Man United. Our other friend Will, he was going by Munich just because he wanted to irritate us, possibly. I don't know. And he was, you know, he was glowing. He was glowing. And Nick and I were all dejected. This is the first time we'd ever seen a British club in a European final that we could remember. And in the last 3 minutes, they came back and they scored two goals and they won the European Cup. And I'm actually getting butterflies and feeling a bit funny, tingly right now just talking about it. Worst moment, hands down, it's the 1996 Euros semi-final, England versus Germany. All those hopes, again, I was a kid, first time I saw the England national team get to any kind of decent level that I could remember. I was too young really to remember the 1990 World Cup. And it was in England, and there's always hype around it, and you believe the hype when you're that age. And we're in the semis, and Paul Gascoigne missed scoring this goal, which would have won it by about an inch, and it went to penalties. And of course, because it goes to penalties, what happens? Just like what happened very recently with the Euros final, we lost. And so I cried a lot. I went home and saw my mom and cried some more. And that'd be the standout memory in terms of worst ever sporting moment.
And I think for me, and I was actually thinking about this. So the best, hands down, and I'll use their old name, had to be the first Redskins Super Bowl. I mean, that was just, and that was 83. And it was just magical. I mean, and I was a kid, so I go back to that's when everything is possible and you're not jaded by the adulthood. And I was going to say the worst was the following year when they lost to the Raiders, or maybe I'm a big Georgetown fan. So the year they lost to Villanova was tough. But what I thought about was maybe it was about 4 years ago and the Nationals had a first round of the playoffs, and it was game five against the Dodgers in DC. And I went with my youngest son, and he was in high school, and he had never seen, where I talked about, I grew up seeing winning teams. He grew up never seeing winning teams. And it was game five. And I mean, the game started at 8 PM and it ended at 1:45 in the morning. and Clayton Kershaw from the Dodgers came in relief and just crushed the Nationals. And it was just so depressing. And but on one hand, it was one of the best games I've seen, but it was just so depressing. Chris talked about the Baltimore Orioles and being in D.C. before we had the Nationals. I was an Orioles fan when they had when Edward Bennett Williams was the owner. And now the Orioles have this owner called Peter Angelos now, who is not doing as well with the franchise. And I'm with the Washington football team, Dan Snyder, not doing as well. But then conversely, Bill, you're talking about that Formula One team with Toto Wolff at the helm. And they're doing very well. So let me ask both of you, what role does ownership play in the success of an organization or a franchise?
I think it's huge. It's the same concept of, you know, how's your board of directors? What's your CEO? It's really, it's the guiding post for what's going on out there. You know, I mean, you look, you know, for me, I look at the Chiefs and the Hunt family has owned them forever. And Lamar Hunt, who the founded the Chiefs because he wanted to get an NFL team, but they wouldn't sell him one. So he founded the AFC, or, you know, the American Football League. And so he was a trendsetter. He went forward big in soccer as well, too, for their support there. But it really goes to the character of the individual that comes in. Are they in it for a quick grab? Are they in it for the long run? Are they in it to create a culture of success and put it out there? And, you know, sometimes teams aren't. Some, you know, you get owners that are just kind of there and it's fun to watch them, you know, and they just like the churn of the money that comes through because you get a fan base. So the Washington football team has a fan base regardless, you know, and you're living on the past glory years and you're paying either for seats, concessions, things like that. And so they're happy with that. So they want minimal results. And so when you look at it from some certain standpoints, what's their investment, you know, in the process? How are they doing it? Are they doing it just because it's neat on their portfolio to own a team? Does it get them, you know, grandeur? Or are they really focused on creating a winning championship style and process and team there? We'll pick the New England Patriots, for instance. Robert Kraft came in there and turned the franchise around, you know, when he purchased it. And it was just a different attitude and mentality. And, you know, he had the luck of getting a couple of good people and coaching and playing and stuff like that, which is always helpful. But the ability for him to come in and change the attitude from what had been a losing franchise for the most of the years they were there, minus 85, and moving him forward was really his attitude, his commitment, and his drive that's there. So it goes back to that CEO role. You know, what are they there for? You know, do they understand what the community wants, the community needs, the organization needs, the organization wants? What's the culture they're walking into? Do they leverage that or do they strip it? So,
yeah. And I think that the interesting thing is the previous owner of the football team, Jack Kent Cook, you know, we call him the blueprint. He owned the Lakers and they won titles. I believe he owned the Maple Leafs also. I am not sure.
Not sure. He may have. Yep.
I'll check. But then he owned the Redskins and his whole motto was, I come in, I sign checks, I build loyalty, I stay out of the way of the coach and GM and maybe resolve some issues with both between the coach and the GM. Bill, let me ask you the same question, but also from a soccer standpoint, as the Football Association, mainly the EPL, has started to have American owners and Middle East owners. How has that impacted the league and teams?
Yeah, so, I mean, just go back to what Chris was saying, that you can get some great owners who really contribute and you can get some other owners who do the opposite and they suck the life out of a club. And we've seen examples like Kroenke here at Arsenal or the Glazers over at Manchester United who come in and you could argue that they do it either just for the money or they do it for the kudos, but they're not there for the real why. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always like to talk about the why and I like to chat about some of the lessons from Simon Sinek and his books, because that it's so important within sport, and it's so important more generally within business. Sure, you get companies where the founder is involved, okay, the owner is involved, but what happens when they leave? How do you maintain that? Why? How do you keep people rowing in the same direction that a company was set up in the first place? And we see a lot of examples in soccer where folk have come in, they bought up a club, and they don't care about the why. They don't care that Manchester United was built as a family club with an attacking mindset, and it was supposed to be a club that reinvests its money in youth, for example. In the last couple of months, the Glazers have said lots of positive things, which are trying to win over the fans. I'm not convinced yet, personally. But when you get it right, and you get someone like Abramovich, even though he's a contentious human being outside of the football space, the soccer space, but in terms of coming in and genuinely wanting to build something and build a legacy, and he's created a club now which has won 2 European Cups, countless Premier Leagues, numerous FA Cups, and so on and so forth. I respect people like that.
But then doesn't it get to what I found is, I've always found it gets to how you make your money. So I mentioned Jack Kent Cook earlier, and he owned the LA Kings, but he started out as an encyclopedia salesman in Toronto, door to door. And I think one of Dan Snyder's contemporaries I always compare him to is Mark Cuban. Like Mark Cuban did IT sales to put himself through college. So there's always been a customer experience aspect to how he made his money. And that translates to how he owned his team. I think Dan Snyder was a bond trader, you know, so there was no connection to the fans, to the team, to that sense of culture and community. So I think looking at like Norwich, I mean, you can help me out here, but the fact that Delia Smith has owned them for years, there seems to be a local connection between her and the community and the fans, as opposed to if it was some American corporation like the Fenway Group or Kroenke's who came in.
Yeah, I mean, listen, first and foremost, I believe it should be Queen Delia, or better yet, President Delia of the People's Republic of Norfolk, okay, separating from the rest of the United Kingdom, because she is a wonderful human being. And she deserves all the accolades she can get. However, the reality with Delia is she's limited on funds. I mean, you look at the current lineup of teams in the Premiership this year, the Premier League, the EPL this year, and I'm pretty sure Norwich are going to be right at the bottom there in terms of the funds, the money from the ownership, and they have a policy of not going bust because they are what folk call a yo-yo team. They'll go up, they'll go down. If they spend a lot of money, that's a huge risk. And if they get relegated, then they could go bust. And Delia's had her fingers burned in the past. This is not her first rodeo, and she's not prepared to do that. So, I can't speak for all Norwich fans out there, certainly. But we love her. She is one of us. She's been a fan since she was a girl. She does things in a prudent way, a fiscally responsible way. But it'd be nice to be able to dream about some big oligarch or whatever coming from somewhere who is also a Norwich fan and has money and could get us into the Champions League. Because right now we don't have that, you know. So is it a trade-off? Do you have someone who's genuinely rooted into the team, into that ethos, into the history, but they haven't got the cash to splash? Or do you go for some big Joe who doesn't really get what the team's about, but they've got money? Hopefully you can find someone who's a bit of both. But that's the secret sauce. And it's certainly something that seems to be limited to the bigger clubs when we're talking soccer.
So let me ask you, we've talked about owners. Let's get into who some of our favorite coaches and managers across, you know, you pick your sport. Chris, who are the managers or coaches that you really find that you are interested in and like?
I'm going to go back to the Chiefs right here with this, and primarily because I've watched a lot of poor coaches come through the process and poor GMs go through in there. But Andy Reid is somebody who I've watched for his whole career. So when he was at Philadelphia, he produced winners. You know, he made it back. He didn't really win the big game, but he produced winners, and he did it in a way that the fan base in Philly, which is very much a fickle, vicious fan base that can be out there, were supportive of him. And they were even supportive of him after he left the organization and moved to the Chiefs, you know? And so if you can have a history of having your fan base from your old team where you were fired from supporting you when you're playing in the championship game of the world, it tells a lot about your character, your ability to lead and the like. And, you know, one of the things that I've seen great with him over the years, and he's been supported by GMs, you know, that have been good and bad in the process. You know, he was bad too when he got the GM, the role, but, you know, from the coaching standpoint, the ability for him to pull together the team in the way that he does and leverage their strengths. You know, right now you have Patrick Mahomes and he's throwing the ball everywhere. Okay. But you have seen other teams of Andy Reid's where they run the ball all the time. And they're really, you know, it really is, he leverages the strengths of the talent that he has around him. And I think that's really good. And he also lets his coaches coach and he's loyal to them. He doesn't send them to the wind if they have, you know, if they're kind of have a rough go at it at times. He has a strong sense of loyalty. So when I look at him, I think that's really a good testament of a leader. You know, I referenced earlier in the conversation, Jerry Sloan, who had a really hard work attitude. You know, we're going to win this with blue collars on and we're just going to, you know, wear you down to death by playing fundamental basketball on a pick and roll. And he really, you know, adhered to that and stayed with it. And he had the talent that would do that. So he had a great idea, stuck with it, moved forward with it, and then produced, you know, championship results out of it along those lines. And then, you know, as you look at some of the others, you know, Celtics, way back when, the Celtics had great coaches over time, and they were always good at leading the organization to, you know, multiple championships. And it wasn't just because people wanted to live and play at the Garden. You know, it was just that they had a chance to bring the talent in. There was a bonding and a loyalty that came of supporting Red Auerbach or whomever it was at the time that they were playing, and just focusing around that leader. So I think that some of these coaches that I look at, you know, are really ones that get personal with the teams. They leverage the strengths. They create a culture that's more family oriented and bring people in. And so that's kind of where I'm thinking that's a great opportunity for good coaches to live and reside.
Bill, what are your thoughts?
I have a list here, Russell. I've been giving this a thought as Chris was speaking there. I've got a little bit of a list that I've come up with. So bear with me, please. Let's start with Sir Clive Woodward, just because he won the 2003 World Cup in the rugby. No, more than that. He changed the whole culture of the team, actually. The England national rugby men's team were a team of drinkers, and they're quite arrogant. And they weren't particularly liked by the crowd necessarily. He came in, he brought in a completely new level of professionalism as the sport itself moved from being an amateur sport to a professional sport. So not only did he win the Six Nations and the World Cup, he changed the philosophy at the national level of rugby. He brought in his lessons from when he was the Leicester coach, I think. So Clive Woodward, Billy Beane. I don't know too much about Billy Beane, but everything that I've read about him and what he did over the Oakland A's, got a lot of respect for him. Just talking Formula One for a moment, Toto Wolff, because he's a natural winner and he instills that within the team. It helps that he has Lewis there, of course. Frank Williams and Dennis and Ron Dennis as well. Frank Williams, until very recently, was the head of Williams, the F1 team, and he had very different ideas, and his passion meant that they were successful in the 80s, but he continued throughout a whole bunch of ill health and issues with his family. And he's just a great role model to people. People who've got a passion, they really want to do something. He started that team from scratch. So he has to be on my list. And Ron Dennis, for similar reasons, great passion. He's the one who brought through Lewis. I think you're seeing a general Lewis theme here throughout most of my answers. Who else? So Matt Busby. going back to the 50s, 60s and 70s era. I didn't see him as a manager, of course, or his players, but that man rebuilt a team, literally rebuilt a team. The Munich air disaster killed goodness knows how many of the players and staff. He was one of the lucky ones to survive that air crash, along with Sir Bobby Moore. And he had to start from scratch. He had this league winning team and he lost all his fantastic young lads. And to go through that degree of devastation and to come back and to create a new team only about 10 years later that went on to win the European Cup. Maybe he's the top one in here. A couple others, though, that I would mention. Sir Alex Ferguson. I don't know how much we need to say about that. The greatest football manager of all time, I think. And I just want to give a little bit of lip service to Gareth Southgate. I don't think he had the right tactics in the final. That's a different discussion. But again, similar to what I said about Clive Woodward, he changed the culture within the top level of the men's soccer team. And they're now a group of players that I can respect. And I've never, ever had that as an England football fan before. The way they conduct themselves, the way that they speak, the inclusivity that's been brought in by Gareth, it's something else. There are a lot of things not to be proud of in England, but he and his team is something to be proud of. Unfortunately, the fans let themselves down. But again, that's probably a discussion for another time.
So let me ask you, if you had to, you gave a nice list, and I started with Clyde Woodward, but then you went to a little bit more depth with Matt Busby and Gareth Southgate. If you had to pick one of those, if all of them were alive and said you could only pick one to have a one night conversation to pick their brain, which one would you choose?
It's got to be Sir Alex, I think.
Because
he's a natural winner, and he doesn't take no for an answer, and wherever he goes, things turn to gold, and not all of his players love him, but all of them respect him, and I'm not saying that's a modern way to lead. Certainly, in football now, in soccer now, you'd be hard pressed to find someone who leads like he led. And you know, it was less than 10 years ago that he retired. But all of his former players respect him, and they talk very highly of the work ethic that he instilled in them because of his upbringing. He worked on the shipyards in Govan in Glasgow before he got his opportunities within sport. So I guess he'd be number one, although it'd be quite nice to have Gareth there, maybe Sir Gareth soon, as well as Matt Busby too.
And Chris, you mentioned Andy Reid and Red Auerbach. If you had to choose between those two, same question, or is there a dark horse? Who would you choose?
Oh, there are a lot of dark horses. I'm going to go with Andy because he's been able to replicate his success at different locations. You know, you look, and Red was in Boston, and that was great. And, you know, everybody loved him there. But, you know, you look even at Phil coming from L.A. and going to New York and not being able to replicate that. So Phil Jackson. So I go back to Andy and say, you know, really being able to do that time and time again is great. And I'm going to give a shout out to one of your guys, too, Joe Gibbs. You talked about, you know, Joe Gibbs eras and things like that. He won those Super Bowls with different quarterbacks. And it was amazing that you take the leader of the team and are able to do that. And then he quits. He walks away a champion. He walks away a winner and then goes off to race because we've been talking about racing. But for me, it is really, you know, right now I'm going to say Andy Reid for a variety of reasons. I'll stick with that.
See, I'm big with Joe Gibbs. I'm glad you mentioned that because not only did he have a different quarterback, he had a different running back in every Super Bowl. And he went, and the interesting thing was when he started his NASCAR team, it was literally, I'm going to follow Jack Kent Cook's model. I'm going to get the best talent, and I'm going to build loyalty and get out of their way. Big on Sir Alex Ferguson. Big on, I mean, Chris mentioned Phil Jackson. I'm big on Phil Jackson. I'm also big on Carlo Ancelotti. Because I just love his quiet leadership style and how everything is really about the family, and that he goes into every job with the realization that he will, either by his choice or the board's choice, he will leave every job. So there's a level of reality to what he does. So let's talk about what from sports transitions to business. And I saw something with Toto Wolff where he talked about when he started with Formula One, with the Formula One with the Mercedes team, he went into the office the first day and saw like the newspaper was 3 or 4 days old. The counter had coffee stains on it. I think the model of the race car, the little on the table was like 3 or 4 older models. And he realized, okay, I've got to impact the culture. What from sports leadership theory culture have you seen best replicated in the business setting?
My answers have kind of alluded to a need for instilling more professionalism and discipline. And some of the examples that I've spoken about so far have been all about that. Sir Alex Ferguson, for example, Sir Clive Woodward. And maybe that's where I should go in terms of translating that over to company culture. But I'm a millennial. Okay. And I think that millennials and Gen Zers, we're more cash. We don't necessarily like to wear a tie. We don't like to be dictated to. We like to be more autonomous. So I guess Gareth Southgate would be a good example of a leadership style in sport that is something that can be and should be translated over into company culture. He's an inclusive guy. He leads based on the numbers, on the data, which is really important as well. And we see this transition happening all the time right now within the world of HR, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of your typical CHROs right now, they've got a data analytics background instead of perhaps a people background per se. So I think bringing data side into business is more and more important. Companies not doing that by now, catch up, is 2021. The inclusivity that Gareth Southgate has brought in, and the camaraderie and the support that all of the players of his team give for each other, and the intelligence that they offer in their answers. If some of that can be replicated in a company culture where we're supportive, where we're pro equity, we're pro professionalism, professionalism in the sense that we represent ourselves and we represent the employer brand in the right ways, then these are the sort of lessons that I think are more appropriate to get today, as opposed to professionalism in the sense that it's very strict and you've got to have an authoritarian person at the top, because that kind of approach doesn't work anymore. It's not the 90s, forget about that.
Chris, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I like to get away from the authoritarian component. One of the things when I look at Andy Reid, and I'm just going to stick with that example, is that, and I've referenced slightly, is when he came in, it was a 2-something team. And the next year he took him to a positive record, I think even to the playoffs. And what it was just an attitude adjustment. He came in and was able to lead. So similar to what Bill said, came in, looked at, stains here and old versions of the car. He came in and said, look, this is what we need to do. And he shaped up the locker room. He got team leaders involved. He trusted his GMs to get him players. He trusted his coaches to start doing what they were supposed to do, coaching. And then he was able to focus on his specific activity. And in this world, of course, it's the offensive minded, wizard that he is for football, American football. And you just watched him go through this. And, so he created this environment that was just wonderful, like family oriented, from the outside perspective. One of his philosophies was treat people the way I'd want to be treated. And that's kind of there. And you hear from other players, they want to play for him. You hear from players that have played for him saying, it wasn't about, hey, you dropped the ball. It was like, hey, what's going on in your life? Let's talk about your family. Let's try to do this thing. So it was an involved in a personal commitment. It was an understanding that was there, and let's do the best thing and move forward that way. So I think when you're looking at that leadership style, you're looking at it from the standpoint of, you know, I'm not just coming in from the outside, you know, doing it the quote unquote IBM way or the XYZ company way. It's, you know, I'm coming in, I've got some core principles and values. And I think it's those principles and values which really drive some of our leaders to do well in creating that family environment. You know, the Chiefs, for those who may or may not be aware, had a player that was just a great running back. Okay. And then he got involved with a domestic issue, and the Chiefs had been supporting him. And then they found out he lied to them and they had to cut him. So the interesting thing was, a year ago, you watched those, you know, the gentleman sat out of suspension, came back with another team. They played last year in the playoffs, and you see him give him a big hug after the game. Both the player and the coach were hugging, you know, and here's a guy that had been, you know, quote unquote disciplined and let go, but there still was that mutual respect there. So when you look at that aspect of leadership, is it somebody I can trust? Is it somebody I want to commit to? We talk about, you know, levels of involvement or engagement. These are engaged people, and they're doing it because of that culture that's been established. And I think that's important for us to look at when we're doing, you know, they're sold on the way it's being done. You know, Phil Jackson in LA, sold on that. Phil Jackson in Chicago, sold on that methodology of the triangle offense. You know, people were invested, came to New York, couldn't get the same buy-in, you know. And maybe times changed and maybe it was time for a different methodology. But, you know, you get that sales, you get that respect and authority with the leaders or with your unit because you earn it.
You think Vince Lombardi would be a success today?
You know, I don't know if Vince Lombardi would be a success today. And I'm going to tell you that my answer from my own gut feel, no. Okay. He wouldn't be. Because he is focused, he was focused on, you know, kind of a strict disciplinarian of, you know, be here, do this, you know, I'm going to control this aspect of life. And I think we've migrated away from that to treat our millennials, like Bill said he is, you know, differently. We it's a different space, it's a different world, and you can't have that, especially with the players making, you know, money. Back when Lombardi,
there was no free agency.
No free agency. You were committed to the team, you know, but also, you know, a lot of them had jobs outside.
Yeah.
You know, in the off season, they had another job to help support their family. And so now all of a sudden we create these, I don't want to say prima donnas, but we create these talents that are viewing themselves with such a high degree of, you know, worth.
Yeah.
That you can't treat them that way anymore. I don't think. You know?
No. And the challenge is, so my three kids are 29, 27, and 21. Mm-hmm. And we've raised them that they have that value. They have that worth. And, you know, I'm a voice researcher. So employees are naturally wanting to feel empowered to have that voice and articulate their ideas. And I just felt, it's funny because I hear these Bill notes. I've been doing a lot of reading and listening to British managers, and they all reference Lombardi. And I was like, that's a totally different, like, era. Totally different era. I mean, we're looking at things. The NBA was last night. Well, you know, or soccer with the Premier League, a player can sign a 5-year contract, 30, 40 million a year. And then year two be like, you know, or you look at James Harden. 2 years left on the contract. Hey, I'm ready to move on. That being said, I think the Celtics, so much of that was Red, but mm-hmm. Red wielded with an iron fist. I mean, he loved his players who bought in, but if you didn't, he had all of the leverage.
Yep.
So Bill, what I wonder about for Sir Alex Ferguson and also throwing Arsene Wenger in is, do you think in the Premier League we're going to have those two type of managers where they're leading a top flight team for over two decades? Or are we looking at the Pep Guardiolas that move around, the Zidanes, the Ancelottis?
So let me break down your question a little bit there, because if you're asking me as part of that, are we going to have those types of people? As well as the longevity piece. No, I'd say no, we won't see we won't see an Arsene Wenger or Alex Ferguson type leader again in the EPL, because it was my way or the highway for both of those guys. It was either, just like you were saying there about buy-in, it was either you believe in what I'm doing or you're out. There are no big hugs and let's talk about your feelings and all that kind of thing, particularly on the Ferguson side, I think. Can I see someone staying for 20 plus years? I would have said no before Jürgen turned up, you know, but this guy, although I feel like he'll want to go somewhere else. But if Jürgen Klinsmann at Liverpool wanted to stay for 20 years, he's clever enough to continue to build success and the fans and even fans of other clubs like me. We just love the guy. We buy into him. And I think actually he's a perfect example of what a modern leader is today. He's charismatic, he's friendly, and he's very, very compassionate. And these are all the qualities that I certainly respect, and I think players respect. So if it's someone like him, sure. But otherwise, no, I just can't see it. I think there's too much churn. I think there's too much money in the game and a whole bunch of other things that means that otherwise, sadly, you'd never see that again.
So when we look at the direction things are going now, and Bill, you talked about some of the racial abuse players suffered at the end of the Euros. And Chris and I are here representing our Washington football team and Kansas City Chiefs, and Indian names tend to, I mean, I think it's a matter of time for the Braves, the Indians, and the Chiefs. The Reds, the football team has already changed their name. As millennials and Gen Zs come in to the workforce, there seems to be employee engagement and happiness is also driven by corporate social responsibility. So as we move forward, what does that equate to what you see in the world of sports, but also in HR?
I'm going to be a bit contentious here, and I'm going to start by just saying that I think there's something systemically wrong within English. I'm not going to say British, but I think English society that leads to a situation where you've got fans behaving like that. And a lot of those fans were millennials. They were Gen Zers. I'm also a Canadian. I'm a proud Canadian. I'm not such a proud Brit sometimes when I see stuff like that. Right now, we're all about the war for talent, okay? And it's never been as fierce as it is right now. And companies are struggling to attract top talent and then to retain them. And that means that a company's got to stand for something. And that means that there needs to be a clear mandate for what their corporate social responsibility efforts and desires are. If you're just a company these days that's about making money, you're not going to attract the right people, and you're not going to keep them. And what I mean by the right people are the people who actually care. They buy into your why. They buy into it to such an extent that they will stand up. They'll use their voice to try and make change within the organization. I've got a fairly new perspective as well now that I'm a father. I've been a father for a year. So when I look at companies and I see what they're doing, I interviewed a guy recently, for example, on the HR Chat show, who he puts a certain amount of cents from every dollar that his company makes in terms of replanting trees. Okay. That kind of thing is even more important to me now than it was before my son was born, because I've got a longer term perspective now. So it's companies that really stand for making a difference that I buy into, and I believe a lot of people who are not just millennials and Gen Zs, I think we're all woken up to this. But yeah, it's super important. And if you don't stand for things, if you're not authentic in your brand, then you shouldn't expect to be able to attract the right people.
Yeah, I agree. You know, we're at that point where, you know, Earth Day, which is a U.S. holiday, I think it's U.S. holiday only, you know, means more now than it ever did, you know. And I've had clients over the years that started this, you know, I had one client back from 2001 or something, always would want their group members, their organization members, to invest in something about the environment, you know, and doing that type of thing. And so as we see it, you know, we've gone from just investing in the environment, but also to the social changes, the DEI, you know, components that we work with and deal with now. And it's really important, and it's socially, it's social responsibility for us to look at that. And I see that, you know, in the HR space, the organizations that can accept that and bring it in and mold it into their culture, you know, again, it's the cultural aspect of it. If it's a bolt-on and it doesn't really fit, and, you know, business is done differently than what you're preaching, then it's broken. It's really got to be integrated and woven into the fabric of where you are and the organization that's there. And that takes time, but it also takes committed leadership, and that leadership needs to be willing to invest that time to make it happen, not just have a program here or there, but to really make it part of their culture and the cloth of their existence.
Last question, guys. What are some of your favorite sports leadership books?
Yeah, that's a great question. You put that out there, and there's a lot of them. And you know, as we talked about the concept a few minutes ago where you said, you know, would Vince Lombardi or Red Auerbach have this same success? And so a lot of times when you look at these leaders, you know, John Wooden or whomever, you know, as you look at some of the theory books that come out there, that from these past coaches and players, they come, they go, but, you know, sometimes their teachings are for the generation that they were working in. You know, it was really something to look at and say, wow, that's really cool what they did when they did it. So it's almost like a historical book for me. You know, when I look at that, what I like is some more of the contextual pieces of our current leaders that are doing well, sports leaders. So, you know, more article based activities. I think that's more relevant for some of our HR spacing right now than just the book the way John Wooden did or Newt Rockne did it. You know, there are different aspects around that. There are some, and one individual that I ran into years ago, Alan Fine, he was a tennis coach. He's British, tennis coach, golf coach, and created a company called Inside Out Development on coaching. And his methodology is agnostic, to say the least. It doesn't matter what you're doing, you know, who you are, what you're going through. The methodology that he and the tool sets that he gives to a manager as a coach are really great. So if I can find books like that written by people like him that have pulled out, you know, the personality, the flair of the winds that were there and come to core basics of human understanding and behavior that are making people better, removing roadblocks, you know, enabling folks to see, you know, that glimpse of what made them good, but it and how it really translates to today and where they can put it. Those are the books that I like, and we work through that process.
Bill?
So despite what I said about how maybe his philosophy wouldn't necessarily work today, a book that I would point to, because the underlining messages that they're in the book are essential and foundational, is from Sir Alex Ferguson. I think it was 2015. It's called Leading, Learning from Life and My Years at Manchester United. It's a series of anecdotes, okay, as opposed to a clear philosophy. But with it, he keeps reinforcing the importance of certain self-discipline and key behaviors that we should all try and live by. On top of that, of course, you can expect to have a caring, compassionate, inclusive leadership style and all the rest of it, sure. But before you even get there, you know, he keeps espousing the importance of getting to work early, being disciplined and being focused. He talks about building rather than buying, and he's a proven winner. So that's a great book. Just to reiterate, I don't think necessarily all of his managerial style would work now, but those core tenets, I was a Boy Scout, Russell, I believe some of these core tenets as well. I think if you've got the foundational level, you can learn the rest of the stuff. So that's a great one. And then not necessarily a leadership book, but something which I point out to your listeners, which I found super interesting, is a book called Soconomics. Which is based on Wickonomics, of course. And it tries to equate some of the lessons from Moneyball into soccer. And those lessons were actually tried with teams like Watford, who are kind of a similar team to Norwich in the sense that they get promoted and relegated quite a lot. And they had a manager there for a while who tried to buy based on stats. Quite a lot of the information in there maybe doesn't translate, but it's a really interesting read. And, you know, in terms of how to approach team building, some of them you can borrow, the rest of it maybe you put to one side, but it's great just to get a different perspective.
Yeah, and I think for me, I have on my bookshelf here in the back Sir Alex Ferguson's Leading. So love the book, I love the balance for how he connects with people, but he's still an authoritarian figure. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. The way his former players revere the respect for him is very good. Phil Jackson's 11 rings, and I get it. Phil Jackson had ready-made teams, but Phil Jackson had to manage a lot of egos. So he really talks about how you build a culture that connects, a winning culture for a certain group of people. And I know he talked about when he left the second time, he didn't want to coach Kobe when Kobe was no longer Kobe. But he also has a book called The Last Season, which goes to the first time, but I haven't read that yet. The third book is a little known book that's hard to find, and it's called The Edge by Ben Littleton, who I believe is the writer for The Guardian or The Telegraph. And it really talks about what business can learn from football. And he just has unprecedented access to Premier League, not just Premier League, but soccer managers in Europe. And he has a chapter, because I'm an employee voice guy, on how Didier Deschamps built a voice culture for that France team that won the World Cup. It's one of the best books I've read. I think I read it a couple of years ago when I turned 50, because I remember I was in Costa Rica reading it. So that's how I remember to find it. Really good book. So with that being said, Chris and Bill, thanks for joining for this conversation. I'd love to have another one. We got to figure out how we do some season kickoff so we can do this again and explore different avenues. Cause I think, you know, we just touched on some stuff. This has kind of been a purview, overview as opposed to, but we could deep dive on several topics. So do you guys have any last words or thoughts? Bill first.
Firstly, thank you so much, Russell. You're an extraordinary gentleman, sir. I've got a lot of respect for you. I want to keep finding ways that we can do stuff together. This has been a great conversation. Usually I only get to talk about the HR talent leadership side of things. Today I actually get to talk about one of my passions, which is sport as well. And it's been a lot of fun. So let's definitely find a way to do this again soon.
Chris.
I would love it as well. Russell, let me just say again, echo what Bill had stated. Thank you so much. This has been fun. It's been relaxing. It's great. I want to learn more about your voice stuff, because that sounds intriguing to me. So maybe I need to listen to more of your podcasts and also focus more in understanding that for you, because I think it's a lot of what we do too. But ultimately, yeah, this is great coming back together and having a session. And, you know, we look at this crowd. Well, we are looking, but this is an audio only session. There are three guys here, and I'd love to get some diversity. I'd love to bring another, at least a woman on our panel here, and get some focus there and get a different perspective on what we're doing and talking about here, because I think that would make us, you know, even better from listening, but also, you know, it's good discussion back and forth, I think. So I look forward to it if we can. Thank you, Russell.
Cool. And I guess one last thing for both of you, how can people find you?
So
Bill first. Yeah,
if I may, thank you. So for me, you can learn about the HR Gazette and the HR Chat podcast by going to hrgazette.com or hr-gazette.com. They both go to the same place. I am super active on LinkedIn. So that's Bill Banham. I'm not the former head of Virgin. I'm the other one with loads of HR related things going on. And I'm not on TikTok because I'm not that cool. I'm also on Twitter, so you can probably find me there too.
And Chris,
for me, the best place is join me on LinkedIn, Christopher Bjorling, full name with a T, Christopher, and love to have us link up that way. Then also, if you want to look more what our organization does, you can look at us at Twitter or on LinkedIn or online for Fidello.com. Or Fidello, and that's F-I-D-E-L-L-O. It talks about our organization and what we do and our belief structure with that as we help organizations get better at people management.
Cool. Thanks, guys, for joining.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I want to thank Bill Banham with HR Gazette, HR Chat, and Chris Bjorling with Fidello. What I really liked about that was, again, we taped this in July 2021, right after the Euros. So as we talked about how sports relates to leadership and organizational culture, we brought in all aspects of good owners, bad owners, how they say good culture, bad culture, how sports have changed, how there's this social responsibility desire from athletes to have their voices heard. And if you look at what's going on in the workplace now, we're focusing on how employees can have their voices heard. You guys know I like sports. So out there, I have a conversation with Matt Manners with Inspiring Workplaces. He's a New York Jets fan. God bless him. We had a conversation about sports. That was really the first one of these sports and leadership conversations we did. And then in the Speaker Box archives, there's a great pod with Stefan Warburton. He's also with Inspiring Workplaces, where we really talked about sports and race. And then my last pod, we didn't really get too much into sports, was with Twan Russell, the athletic director of St. Thomas Aquinas. So definitely give those a listen if you like what you heard. Like the pod, subscribe to the pod, give a great review to the pod. Want to give a shout out to my main man, Reggie Quinterly, for the theme song, The Virginia Gentleman. Thanks for listening. Everybody have a great evening.